Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
So we were in the section of Emor, which is the book of Leviticus, chapter 21 through chapter 24. Jehovah said to Moses, "Say to the Kohanim, the sons of Aaron, and tell them, each of you shall not contaminate himself to a dead person among his people, except for the relative who was closest to him, to his mother and to his father, to his son, to his daughter, and to his brother, and to his virgin sister who is close to him, who has not been wed to a man. To her he shall contaminate himself. A husband among his people shall not contaminate himself to one who desecrates him. They shall not make a bald spot on their heads, and they shall not shave an edge of their beard, and in their flesh they shall not cut a gash. They shall be holy to their God, and they shall not desecrate the name of their God. For the fire offerings of Jehovah, the food of their God, they offer, so they must remain holy. They shall not marry a woman who is a harlot or who has been desecrated. And they shall not marry a woman who has been divorced by her husband, for each one is holy to his God. You shall sanctify him, for he offers the food of your God. He shall remain holy to you, for holy am I, Jehovah, who sanctifies you. If the daughter of a Kohen will be desecrated through adultery, she desecrates her father. She shall be consumed by fire. The Kohen who is exalted above his brethren, upon whose head the anointment oil has been poured, or who has been inaugurated to don the vestments, shall not leave his head unshorn, and shall not rend his garments. He shall not come near any dead person. He shall not contaminate himself to his father or his mother. He shall not leave the sanctuary, and he shall not desecrate the sanctuary of his God. For a crown, the holy oil of his God anointed, is upon him. I am Jehovah. He shall marry a woman in her virginity, a widow, a divorcee, a desecrated woman, a harlot. He shall not marry these. Only a virgin of his people shall he take as a wife. Thus shall he not desecrate his offspring among his people. For I am Jehovah who sanctifies him. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron, saying, Any man of your offspring throughout their generations in whom there will be a blemish shall not come near to offer the food of his God. For any man in whom there is a blemish shall not approach. A man who is blind or lame, or whose nose has no bridge, or who has one limb longer than the other, or in whom there will be a broken leg or a broken arm, or who has abnormally long eyebrows, or a membrane on his eye, or a blemish in his eye, or dry skin eruptions, or a moist skin eruptions, or has crushed testicles. Any man from among the offspring of Aaron the Kohen who has a blemish shall not approach to offer fire offerings of Jehovah. He has a blemish. The food of his God he shall not approach to offer. The food of his God from the most holy and from the holy he may eat, but he shall not come to the curtain. And he shall not approach the altar, for he has a blemish. And he shall not desecrate my sacred offerings. For I am Jehovah who sanctifies them. Moses spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the children of Israel. Chapter 22. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and to his sons, that they shall withdraw from the holiness of the children of Israel, that which they sanctify to me, so as not to desecrate my holy name. I am Jehovah. Say to them, throughout your generations, any man from among any of your offspring who shall come near the holies, that the children of Israel may sanctify to Jehovah with his contamination upon him, that person shall be cut off from before me. I am Jehovah. Any man from the offspring of Aaron who is a Metzorah or a Zav shall not eat from the holies until he becomes purified. And one who touches anyone contaminated by a corpse, or a man from whom there is a seminal emission, or a man who touches any swarming thing through which he can become contaminated, or a person through whom he can become contaminated, whatever his contamination is, the person who touches it shall be contaminated until evening. He shall not eat from the holies unless he has immersed his body in water. After the sun is set, he should become purified. Thereafter he may eat from the holies, for it is his food. He should not eat from a carcass or from a torn animal, be contaminated through it. I am Jehovah. They shall protect my charge and not bear a sin thereby and die because of it, for they will have desecrated it. I am Jehovah who sanctifies them. No layman shall eat of the holy. One who resides the Kohen or his laborer shall not eat of the holy. If a Kohen shall acquire a person, an acquisition of his money, he may eat of it. And someone born in his home, they may eat of his food. If a Kohen's daughter shall be married to a layman, she may not eat of the separated holies. And a Kohen's daughter who will become a widow or a divorcee and not have offspring, she may return to her father's home as in her youth. She may eat from her father's food, but no layman may eat of it. If a man will eat of the holy inadvertently, he shall add its fifth to it and shall repay the holy to the Kohen. They shall not desecrate the holies of the children of Israel, which they set aside to Jehovah. And they will cause themselves to bear the sin of guilt when they eat their holies, for I am Jehovah who sanctifies them. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons and to all the children of Israel, and say to them, any man of the house of Israel and of the proselytes among Israel who will bring his offering for any of their vows or their freewill offerings that they will bring to Jehovah for a burnt offering, to be favorable to you, it must be unblemished male from the cattle, the flock, or the goats. Any in which there is a blemish you shall not offer, for it will not be favorable for you. And a man who will bring a feast peace offering to Jehovah because of an articulated vow, or as a freewill offering from the cattle or the flock, it shall be unblemished to find favor. There shall not be any blemish in it. One that is blind or broken, or with a split eyelid, or a wart, or a dry skin eruption, or a moist skin eruption, you shall not offer these to Jehovah, and you shall not place any of them as a fire offering on the altar for Jehovah. Excuse me. An ox or a sheep that has one limb longer than the other or unsplit hooves, you may make it a donation, but it is not acceptable for a vow offering. One whose testicles are squeezed, crushed, torn, or cut, you shall not offer to Jehovah, nor shall you do these in your land. From the hand of a stranger, you may not offer the food of your God from any of these, for their corruption is in them. A blemish is in them. They will not find favor for you. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, when an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall remain under its mother for 7 days. And from the eighth day on, it is acceptable for a fire offering to Jehovah. But an ox or a sheep or a goat, you may not slaughter it and its offspring on the same day. When you slaughter a feast thanksgiving offering to Jehovah, you shall slaughter it to gain favor for yourselves. It must be eaten on that same day. You should not leave any of it until the morning. I am Jehovah. You shall observe my commandments and perform them. I am Jehovah. You shall not desecrate my holy name. Rather, I should be sanctified among the children of Israel. I am Jehovah who sanctifies you, who took you out, land of Egypt, to be a God unto you. I am Jehovah. Chapter 23. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, Jehovah's appointed festivals that you are to designate as holy convocations, these are my appointed festivals. For 6 days, labor may be done, and on the seventh day is a day of complete rest. A holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is a Sabbath for Jehovah in all your dwelling places. These are the appointed festivals of Jehovah, of the holy convocations, which you shall designate in their appropriate time. In the first month, on the 14th of the month, in the afternoon, is the time of the Pesach offering to Jehovah. And on the 15th day of this month is the festival of Matzot to Jehovah. You shall eat matzot for a 7-day period. On the first day, there shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall do no laborious work. You shall bring a fire offering to Jehovah for a 7-day period. On the 7th day shall be a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you shall enter the land that I give you, and you reap its harvest, you shall bring an omer from your first harvest to the Kohen. He shall wave the omer before Jehovah to gain favor for you. On the morrow of the rest day, the Kohen shall wave it. On the day you wave the omer, you shall perform the service of an unblemished lamb in its first year as a burnt offering to Jehovah. Its meal offering shall be 2/10 ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, a fire offering to Jehovah, a satisfying aroma. And its libation shall be wine, a quarter hin. You shall not eat bread, nor roasted kernels, nor plump kernels, until this very day, until you bring the offering of your God. It is an eternal decree for your generations in all your dwelling places. You shall count for yourselves from the morrow of the rest day, from the day which you bring the omer of the wave, 7 weeks they shall be complete. The morrow of the 7th week you shall count 50 days. And you shall offer a new meal offering to Jehovah. From your dwelling places you shall bring bread that shall be waved, 2 loaves made of 2/10 ephah, they shall be of fine flour. They shall be baked, leavened. First offerings to Jehovah. With the bread you shall offer 7 unblemished lambs in their first year. 1 young bull and 2 rams. There should be a burnt offering to Jehovah with their meal offering and their libations, a fire offering, a satisfying aroma to Jehovah. You shall make 1 he-goat as a sin offering and 2 lambs their first year as peace feast offerings. The Kohen shall wave them upon the first offering breads as a wave serves before Jehovah upon the 2 sheep. They should be holy for Jehovah and for the Kohen. You shall convoke on this very day. There shall be a holy convocation for yourselves. You should not do laborious work. It is an eternal decree in your dwelling places for your generations. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not remove completely the corners of your field as you reap. And you shall not gather the gleanings of your harvest. For the poor and the proselyte shall you leave them. I am Jehovah your God. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the 7th month, on the 1st of the month, there shall be a rest day for you, a remembrance with shofar blasts, a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work, and you shall offer a fire offering to Jehovah. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, but on the 10th day of this 7th month, it is the Day of Atonement. There shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall afflict yourselves. You shall offer a fire offering to Jehovah. You shall not do any work on this very day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to provide you atonement before Jehovah your God. For any soul who will not be afflicted on this very day will be cut off from his people. Any soul who will do any work on this very day, I will destroy that soul from among its people. You shall not do any work. It is an eternal decree throughout your generations. In all your dwelling places, it is a day of complete rest for you, and you shall afflict yourselves on the 9th day of the month in the evening. From evening to evening shall you rest on your rest day. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say, on the 15th day of the seventh month is the festival of Sukkot, a seven-day period for Jehovah. On the first day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. For a seven-day period, you shall offer a fire offering to Jehovah. On the eighth day, there shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall offer a fire offering to Jehovah. It is an assembly. You shall not do any laborious work. These are the appointed festivals of Jehovah that you shall proclaim as holy convocations, to offer a fire offering to Jehovah, a burnt offering and its meal offering, a feast offering and its libation. Each day's requirement, on its day, aside from Jehovah's Sabbaths, and aside from your gifts, and aside from all your vows, and aside from all your freewill offerings, which you will present to Jehovah. But on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you gather in the crop of the land, you shall celebrate Jehovah's festival for a seven-day period. The first day is a rest day, and the eighth day is a rest day. You shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of a goodly tree, the branches of a date palms, the twigs of a plaited tree, and the willows of a brook. You shall rejoice before Jehovah your God for a seven-day period. You shall celebrate it as a festival for Jehovah, a seven-day period in the year, an eternal decree for your generations. In the seventh month shall you celebrate it. You shall dwell in booths for a seven-day period. Every native in Israel shall dwell in booths, so that your generations will know that I caused the children of Israel to dwell in booths where I took them from the land of Egypt. I am Jehovah, your God." And Moses declared the appointed festivals of Jehovah to the children of Israel. Chapter 24. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the children of Israel that they shall take for you pure olive oil, pressed, for illumination to kindle a continual lamp, outside the partition of the testimony, in the tent of meeting. Aaron shall arrange it from evening to morning before Jehovah continually, an eternal decree for your generations. On the pure menorah shall he arrange the lamps before Jehovah continually. You shall take fine flour and bake it into 12 loaves. Each loaf shall be 2/10 ephah. You shall place them in 2 stacks, 6 rows each stack, or 6 in each stack, upon the pure table before Jehovah. You shall put pure frankincense on each, and it shall be a remembrance for the bread, a fire offering for Jehovah. Each and every Shabbat, he shall arrange them before Jehovah continually, from the children of Israel as the eternal decree, eternal covenant. And it shall belong to Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy for him, from the fire offerings of Jehovah, an eternal decree. The son of an Israelite woman went out, and he was the son of an Egyptian man. Among the children of Israel, they fought the camp, the son of the Israelite woman and an Israelite man. The son of the Israelite woman pronounced the name and blasphemed. So they brought him to Moses. The name of his mother was Shilomit, daughter of Divri of the tribe of Dan. They placed him under guard to clarify for themselves through Jehovah. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, "Remove the blasphemer to the outside of the camp, and all those who heard shall lean their hands upon his head. The entire assembly shall stone him. And to the children of Israel you shall speak, saying, any man who will blaspheme his God shall bear his sin. And one who pronounces the blaspheme the name of his God shall be put to death. The entire assembly shall surely stone him. Proselyte and native alike, when he blasphemes the name, he shall be put to death. And a man, if he strikes mortally any human life, he shall be put to death. And a man who strikes mortally an animal life shall make restitution, a life for a life. And if a man inflicts a wound in his fellow, as he did, so shall be done to him, a break for a break, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Just as he will have inflicted a wound on a person, so shall be inflicted upon him. One who strikes an animal shall make restitution, and one who strikes a person shall be put to death. There shall be one law for you. It should be for a proselyte and a native alike. For I, Jehovah, am your God. Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and they took the blasphemer to the outside of the camp. They stoned him to death, and the children of Israel did as Jehovah had commanded Moses. A lot of reading. So that was Leviticus chapter 21 through chapter 24, discussing, of course, the details of the laws of the priests, the details of the various blemishes, as well as festivals, and how you view God. Any questions, comments, opinions, things you want to share with us, things I can answer for you or not? Yes, there's one. Deborah, go for it. What's your question, a comment?
Okay, the divorced woman.
Yes.
So, the divorced woman cannot remarry.
I cannot remarry any of the priests.
The priests. So, however, Christ is the priest, a high priest, right? And are we not his bride? So I was wondering how that re-entry of us, in the law, there is the loophole that states that if no one claims, you know, God gave us a bill of divorcement, correct? I mean, he gave Israel a group of divorcement.
You could argue that.
Yeah, I'm not going to say I know.
I don't argue that.
I'm certainly not saying
I don't argue bill of divorcement.
Well, whatever it is,
because
somehow.
Yeah, it's not so much that he divorced us so much as we played the harlot.
Right. So I mean, I know there's another.
We
way.
Slept around.
Right. I know.
Bottom line, and that's he didn't. Hosea did not issue a divorcement to his wife, even though she was a harlot.
Right.
He
right.
married her, stuck with her, and God
he
said,
told her.
"I'm not divorcing you. I'm not giving you a bill of divorcement.
Putting you over here on the shelf.
But you are cheating on me.
Right.
And I have the right to divorce you.
Ah, okay.
Not so that I'm divorcing you. I have the right to divorce you. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then so, I was wondering how that we got reconnected. And also.
We played the harlot, bottom line.
Right. Yeah. And we touched the touching of a dead body. I know Christ did that right away when he touched the.
He touched a lot of dead bodies and a lot of sick people.
Yeah,
he touched a lot of them. Yep.
However, to them, to the public, that should have, I mean, to then. To the, you know,
they're unclean
in Israel. Yeah. Made him unclean.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and he was by definition, if he's a man, right? He's a man. He touches somebody. He is unclean. And there's a period of time he's unclean for, whether it's one day or a dead body is up to 7 days. And he says it washed his up the third day and the seventh day was washed up. Nothing wrong with it. Messiah didn't say the God did not say you can never become unclean ever.
Right.
No. He said, if you become unclean, that's what you do about it. It's not that you can never become unclean.
Right.
That's absurd. How many of you have ever pooped? if you've never pooped, okay. But if you've pooped before, guess what?
Unclean.
That's unclean. you have to wash, right? Have you ever? Things happen. So becoming unclean is not a problem. It's how do you fix the uncleanliness? How do you address it?
Right.
That's what you do.
We're looking for the remedy.
Right.
And then about the Cohen.
Yes.
Priest, the daughter.
Yes, the burning of the daughter when she sleeps around, yeah.
Yeah. Die, like, that
okay.
daughter.
That's a lot of questions.
And are any of our,
yeah. I should write some of these down before I forget them. Solo Master, you had a question, lots of questions, okay. One was about the harlot. How does Messiah marry us? The unclean, the dead bodies, touching dead bodies. Or unclean people. And the daughter is burned. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Dave.
So my first question is, let's see, back in 21. Anyways, I'm not sure exactly where it's at here, but it was concerning the 7 day that they should stay with their mom. And
that's the tail end of 22. I think the tail end 22, it starts with that. The animal with the 7 days, verse 26 or 27, something like that.
Yeah. 27, where it starts. And,
And
then it says, on the eighth day, it shall be accepted as a sacrifice.
Right.
Or an offering by fire to the Lord. And I'm thinking, you know, I in the back of my mind, I always thought it was a yearling or a year old or something. And I'm thinking, it seems like a pretty minimal sacrifice, an 8 day old,
very small, yes,
bull, very small, not a lot of food there, not a lot of fire, not a lot of flame. So I don't know what's going on there, or if it's just a timeline that says, okay, at 8 days it's good, whenever you decide. Because if I had in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about how us humans think, and I understand why we can't give something up with blemishes, because then it really doesn't mean anything to us. We're going to get rid of it anyways. But the same thing can be said about, you know, a 9-day-old bull. It's like, it's not even matured. I don't have much vested into it.
Right.
I'll just go ahead and sacrifice that, because my yearling, I've got a lot of time and energy in it. He's big, he's strong, and blah, blah, blah. So I'm not sure what's going on there. And then the other thing that I had a question on, in the end of 23, verse 42, where it says, you shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths. And that's the only place I've ever noticed where it just specifically says native born. Mm-hmm. And so I've never noticed that before. And I'm kind of curious. I mean, you know, I was under the, you know, most things say that the same laws shall apply to those that are sojourners or, you know, Nate, you know, that are with you, the foreigner, mm-hmm. but here it specifically says native born. And so mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you knew anything on that or any insight to that and how that would affect those of us that are just grafted in.
Right.
And how that would all play. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's actually, we'll talk about that briefly. Any comments or questions? Okay. So some of these I did not intend to cover, so I will address them right now. Because my spiel won't discuss them in general. The first one, which was your comments, Brigid, that Deborah had asked, the touching of unclean person or a dead body, the priest. So this applies to priests in particular, but it applies to theoretically anyone. If you touch a dead body, you have to be unclean for a certain amount of time. In this instance, as far as when we had discussed, I think it was a couple weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks, whatever it was. We had asked about when we were probably in Tzara'at and Metzora, the skin diseases. We said, well, how does a priest investigate them? The Torah doesn't tell you, can say how he investigates it. I mentioned the time, well, humans, we touch and we prod and we poke, but doctors do this. They stand back and they look at it because they're smarter than the rest of us. They realize, don't touch it because it's on you. The priests, again, would not have generally necessarily touched the item. They may have poked it with a stick, but not going to actually touch the item because they themselves would be contaminated. Now, they're only contaminated until they wash themselves until sunset. So if they check it early in the morning, they touch the person, guess what? You're all fasting for the day. Enjoy your fasting, because you're not allowed to eat anything, because all your food is part of the God's supply. So the priest probably wouldn't touch the contaminated person. They probably would just examine it by looking, or have the person, would you please remove your garment or clothing? Would you please spread the skin this way? Would you please bend your arm such a way so I can see better? So as a smart doctor would do, to not touch, poke, and prod like I do. So that's what they would. That's what they would do. So him touching a contaminated person for disease, he'd be contaminated for that period of time. Now it also specifies here that if person A, was contaminated from a dead body, they're not the dead person, but they're contaminated from a dead body. If the priest then touches person A, who wasn't the dead person, but was contaminated, when a person touches a dead body, you're contaminated for 7 days. But if the priest touches the contaminated person, they're only contaminated for the day, the one day. So the extension of the contamination does not extend for 7 days for everybody who touches you. It's for the 7 day for the person who was in the presence of the dead body, or touched a grave or something like that, and then 1 day for the person who touched that individual. So the contamination then ends beyond that point. And that's a good question. The contagion's about dead bodies. And as far as God's concerned, a dead body is, or God, I shouldn't say we're God, or the Torah's concern, dead body is one of the most contaminated or unclean things you can have, a dead body. There's reasons why in our own culture we have laws about disclosure when someone dies in a house. We have to tell the next buyer, this house, there was a dead person died here. We have to notify them of that part of the disclosure. Well, not everybody does, but you're supposed to notify them by that disclosure. Because the Bible states, the Torah states very explicitly, you cannot be in the same room as a dead person is in or has died there. You cannot touch, this is a priest. This regards to a priest, by the way, a priest, not every human. And the priest is not to attend the funeral of that individual. They are not to touch the grave of the individual or any grave for that matter. Priests are not permitted to do that. Now, the high priest isn't even for his own personal family, but regular priests can do that with their family members, their immediate family members, not uncles, not cousins, not aunts, but parents, wife, certain siblings, and direct children. Not even grandchildren are allowed for regular priests. Now, in our culture, that's thoroughly backwards. In our culture, someone died. Quick, call the local priest or preacher or rabbi. Let's have an officiant service. He'll stand in the service and say a few words, that kind of thing. The Torah, for a Levitical priest, that is prohibited. You cannot do that. Yes, Jared.
Think about a dead human body as an extremely radioactive thing. You don't want to be in the same room, if you're a Levitical priest,
right,
as the...
A dead human.
As a dead human or an extremely radioactive thing.
Right, right. So you cannot attend the funerals if you're a priest. For anybody, if you're a regular priest, not high priest, you may attend your funerals for your parents, for your immediate children, your immediate siblings, and your wife. That is for a regular priest. You can attend those. For a high priest, none of those are permitted. You may not attend a funeral for anybody. Of course, your own. Because you're dead. You're going to be at your own funeral. But nobody else's. You cannot enter the room they're in. You can't touch the body. You can't touch the grave they're buried into. This is the reason, I believe, why Messiah was buried in a grave that no other person had been buried into. Because he can't touch the grave of a dead body. So he's put into a grave that nobody else had been into. Hence, he was not contaminated even in his own personal death. Which is funny, because he touched a lot of dead people when he was alive. But those are contaminated for a period of time, 7 days, and you're clean again. But he wasn't high priest then. He doesn't get high priest until he's resurrected. At that point, he's now becomes a high priest. Before that, he was a man. He was still a man, and he was just doing his job. The high priest, he didn't go to the right hand of God till afterward. That was how that procedure worked. Yes, Anne.
What about the kedusha or whatever they call it? You know, the bathing of the body as the
is not done by
certain people to do.
Yeah,
that
people. There are people that are current Judaism. They hire or contract out individuals and train them to do that. However, in the priesthood, you did not do that. What was that?
Is it in Levitical law?
No.
It's just traditional.
It's traditional law. And the traditional law is that they want to put the body in the ground as quickly as they can.
So when Abraham died, he died in the cave or whatever.
Well, he was buried in the cave. Hopefully he didn't die in there. Right, he was buried in there.
Buried in the cave.
I'm just teasing you. Go ahead.
But that was before the law anyway.
Well, he didn't do anything wrong. He did anything wrong. Abraham was not a high priest. He was not a priest of anything. He was a man. This law is referring to priests and high priests, those groups. An ordinary individual of Israel who was not a priest or high priest, this law about you cannot go to the funerals doesn't apply. It does not apply. When Aaron's sons died, his two sons were killed. Moses explicitly told him, you can't mourn for them, nor can your two sons, but let all of Israel mourn for them. So they can all attend the funeral. You stay here. All right? So the high priest had to stay. He was of the anointing oil, Aaron. Of course, his two sons weren't permitted to leave yet either. But the other two, the dead bodies dragged away. And of course, they had to be buried. But all of Israel attend that funeral. You guys don't get to attend it, even though it's your sons. But Aaron's a high priest, so he cannot attend. You can't take your clothing, you can't shave your beard, you can't gash or show signs of mourning for it. Which, of course, some of our cultures wear black for the rest of your natural life if your spouse dies. It's some do that. I don't. I don't have a spouse that died. I hope they never will. But the point is, some cultures do a lot of it showing outward signs of mourning. Priests and high priests don't do that. You don't get to show the outward sign of your mourning. That makes sense? Any questions or comments regarding this part of the study when it goes to dead bodies and contaminating and graves, things like that? Yes, Larry.
We're supposed to be considered priests.
Mm. Anytime, it discusses here as well, anytime you are contaminated by something, there is a period of time to become uncontaminated. It's that you have to wash yourself on the third day and the seventh day for a dead body. For somebody who is sick, like a disease, it would apply to you as an individual person if you're in the training to be a priest, which was the whole idea of being a kingdom of priests, so trained to be like priests. Not that we necessarily are, but the point is we're trying to understand what that means and try to live that life as you can. Yeah, you and I will never be high priests. That can't happen. So the laws, the high priest laws, will never apply to us. It just won't happen. Now, the regular priest laws, if God so wills it to be, which we'll discuss this in the book of Ezekiel today, for the second part, Ezekiel 44 discusses this in a very interesting detail. We'll get to it. But for anybody else who's in training, the laws of how do you become clean again would apply. It makes sense, which is the bathing process, and of course, is the offerings that go with it. Does that make sense? Oh, yes. What was your comment? You had a question?
Golden calf.
Right.
What did that mean? Okay. I don't know if that was in this one. I wrote a note. And he said, I think of where it was. Maybe it was last week or somewhere in here that said that the sin of the golden calf is what's caused this separation to the people.
That's what separated God from amongst them. He specified that I cannot dwell with these people because I'll kill them. They're full of Well, they idolize it. You made an idol and you worshipped it.
Right.
That is a serious
today,
sin,
right? I mean, today we have maybe like a car or a house, or we idolize.
Idolizing objects are not commonly done today.
So the sin of the golden calf.
Most of us don't idolize objects, right? We know objects are objects. We don't usually idolize them. Idolizing is not the same today as it necessarily was then. The version how we idolize today is usually the form of human beings.
Oh.
You idolize yourself above where you belong. You live to your, that's just a TV show. But the point of the idea is you bring something up higher than it was supposed to or is designed to be.
So the sin of the golden calf has been rectified. That's not.
God is still not with us.
Right.
You noticed?
Yes.
Yeah. So that part is not rectified per se. So until God is with us, which happens in the last chapter of Revelations, he's with us then, but he dwells to dwell with, not like here's a pierced spirit. No, I mean, physically here, you can open, shake his hand. Hi, how you doing? Sit on his lap. That's what we have by with us.
Okay.
That doesn't happen until the end of our Bibles. So that dwelling with us doesn't happen. So that's the point. We know all the previous sins have now been paid and rectified for. Everything. Because he can't be with us. Otherwise, we'd all be dead.
Okay. So now what's happening then is the house of Ephraim is coming. They're starting to come back in the land. It's about almost supposed 70 years. And then because the things that are going on aren't.
You mean like modern day political view things?
Just, I don't know if it's just that so much as it is that spiritually things are going on. And I mean, God's calendar, things are going on. The feast days are to remind us. However, you know, the land is blooming again, and it wasn't supposed to. But so as in the signs for us to be looking like when Christ is second appearing is, you know, are we on that thrust again where we are to be? I mean, we can't keep all these laws perfectly. And we're, you know, it's for myself. Somewhat complicated because I think, but I don't want people to think because of the Sabbath and the feast. Oh, you're under the law. And my aunt and I had a terrible argument. And I said, I'm not under the law, but I'm practicing for the day of the event. And sometimes we could get like, oh, Lord, I gave up workshops. I did all these things. And sometimes within our own selves, we could become, I did all these right things. Why is this happening to me? I know I said that recently and I am sorry, but I did and get alone and. You know, and so,
right.
In prophetically, so the timing is that happening in Israel. Are
you know
with the commandments? Are these? Am I making sense?
I think so. I think I follow you. I could be wrong, so forgive me if I didn't quite follow everything. Regarding the world around you, the last 70 years, a lot of things have happened. Yes, we can see that. from the loss of individuals who have abandoned God and also the bringing in of individuals who have clinged or are clinging to God. That has always been happening for thousands of years. So nothing different is about that. Who and how and why we follow things, that varies from person to person, so I can't speak to them. Generally speaking, the world around me, as long as I know I'm right with God, I really don't care. I just really don't care. I don't care if the Timbuktu nobody from somewhere in some other country gets mad at Timbuktu 3 nobody from another country and they shoot a missile at each other. Even if the Timbuktu 3 person is my next door neighbor and I get killed in the same process, I really don't care. Because I can't do anything about it anyway. Things I can do, which is my wife, my children, my immediate family, the people I serve, I can do those things. So that's where I focus my attention. Anything outside of that, it wasn't given to me. It was given to the leader of some town, the leader of some country, the leader of this, that, and the thing, to bicker and fight about. Let them bicker and fight all they wish. It's outside my realm, so I don't worry about it. I don't care. If a leader of a country says, I'm going to kill you all, and the guy says, well, I'll kill you all back, it's okay, let's shake hands, I really don't care. Or they all hit the red buttons, bam, 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 I really don't care. Because it's beyond my ability to do a single thing about it. I can pray, God, let me live. Let my family live. The people I serve live. However that looks, that's his decision, not mine. So don't worry about it. It's my only advice for you. Don't worry about it. It's beyond your strength. It wasn't given to you to fix. There's a reason God said there are captains of tens, captains of 50s, hundreds and thousands and whole tribes. He didn't assign the captain of 10 to charge the whole tribe. Or the individual being charged with a captain of 10 saying, hey, I'm your subordinate. I'm, you know, the number 9 of the 10. I want to be in charge of the whole country. He didn't do that. He gave it to individuals, let them get the flack, the temperament, the anger, the angst, the blessings, the cursings come with it. Let that individual handle it. They'll do the job it was given to them to do. So let them. Pray that they succeed, whatever God gave them, but let them do their job and you focus on yours. What's given to you? Your life, your family, the people God said here, serve these people. Fair enough? Yes.
So there was a time many, many, many years ago when I kind of went through something like that, like many, many years ago, until I drew a whole lot closer to God. And I just, you know, Yeshua is my peace. Yeshua is my joy. Yeshua is my light. He gives me incredible joy in the midst of struggle. He turns things around for good. So I don't sweat that stuff anymore. He's in control. And we are his children. We're following him. And I feel like he's going to protect us. That's it.
That's his job. That's his job. It was given to him to do.
Yes.
Let him do the job.
Yes. You're under his covering.
Yep. Not so we don't pray for our family, our loved ones. Yes. But the point is you're saying, God, I can't fix it. I need you to help me with this. Now it was given to you to fix it. It was given to you. Okay, this is easy. I'll just do that. I can do that. But if it wasn't given to you, don't worry about it. Yes, David.
I just wanted to make a comment. You know, we're always, I mean, we hear that a lot. Oh, you're under the law. And I think it's either you're under the law or you're above the law. And I think that just makes it easy to think about because I would rather be under the law
and above it.
And to think that I am above the law, because either way, there's still a law, there's still a judgment,
right.
And we're going to be held accountable for something.
Yeah, so I was talking to my son, he was this morning or yesterday, I can't remember. We were discussing this similar topic. He said, when judgment day comes and God pulls out his lists, it's a list of everything you've done, good and bad. And his list, when he said what you should and shouldn't do, and he cross-checks it. He finds a discrepancy. Hey, I said this and you did that. Explain yourself. Now, bottom line, we already know what his list is. It's written here. It's very explicit. It's not a long list, but it's written here. It's only the first five, actually, not even the first book. It's like first Exodus through Deuteronomy. It's listed there. The list is there. And here's your list. Here are your errors. Here's your discrepancies. Now let's address them. Now, some of them we can't fix. Say, yeah, I screwed up. And there's a punishment and correction for each of them. Now, if we go through all the lists and God writes all the corrections out, most of us wouldn't survive the correction, if I'm being honest. So what do we need? A master says, item number 48 down there on year 73, erase that. I'm covering that one. Okay, that one's good. Next one down. Scroll down. Oh, here's another one. So yeah, I'll cover that one too. Erase that line off this person's record too. That's what we depend on. That's what we need, right? If we don't have those erasing marks, it's not going to work. Now, we also have a responsibility with that. If at any point in time, say, Messiah, I don't need you anymore. I don't want you. Or I'm going to live my life how I see fit, regardless of what you said to do. Regardless of what the list of God gave us. Messiah say, okay, I won't be erasing those sections anymore. Because you said I don't need to do it. So you're going to stand on your own. He's take a step back. And then God addresses you. Okay, judgment day. Here's the list. Here's item number, whatever it was. I forgot what number I said before. Here's this item list, this item. And he's not erasing it for you. What's your answer? That's where it's difficult. What you do. You can't go back and relive your life to fix it because you're already dead. This is judgment day. How do you address these issues? These are the issues become difficult if we don't know how to handle them. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Messiah is going to erase every sin you've ever done, regardless of how good of a person you were or how bad of a person you were. I don't personally believe there will be very many Hitlers up there. I just don't. Because Messiah may say, I may erase certain sins, but I'm not erasing certain ones. And some of them are too grievous to actually erase. Payment must be made. I believe the Hitlers will be making those payments. I don't think they're going to be making it. I could be wrong. He may have repented the day before he killed himself. I don't know. But I don't think so. I don't believe every individual will have every sin erased based on how they live their life all the way through to the end. Because some sins still have to be paid for, regardless of what happened. Now, if the person did truly repent, God may say, you know what? I'm covering it. And it's fine. That's his decision, not mine. I don't know that all these individuals have repented. There are the King Herods of the world who really didn't repent. He was really evil all the way to the very end. So there's certain people that just, they didn't repent in this life. I don't think they repent in the next one. It's kind of late then. But that's why God gave two resurrections, though. There's the first one, who was with Messiah, 1,000 years later. And the second one is, okay, all of you who didn't know anything, did it all wrong, screwed it all up, here's your lists. Now, what are you going to do about it? On your second resurrection, those who didn't make it to the first. So that's why I believe why God made two. Because we always have the people that ask, well, what about the Joe Schmo of nowhere who died before the missionary got there, he never heard about Jesus. But yeah, God already covered those. He took care of that. That's called the second resurrection. That's for those individuals who never knew anything. They're still there. They just get there through a different route. Make sense? Okay. Yes, Larry.
One thing that I hear about when Messiah said, he who relaxes these laws and teaches others to do so
will be least.
Shall be called the least.
Not that he won't be there, but it'd be the least.
Well, will he or will he?
Well, least in the kingdom of God. So there's no indication he won't be there necessarily, but it would be least the kingdom of God, which means he's probably looking at the second resurrection at best, not the first. And then whatever that least means, I don't know.
That's what I can't
prove. I can't prove
what is least,
least
and greatest.
Yeah.
In a play in God's kingdom, it doesn't seem like there's any place for that kind of hierarchy, except for the king, the Messiah.
Yeah, the king, Messiah. Well, there's a lot of work involved in Messiah in God's kingdom. There's a lot of work, which the prophets do give us indications, not full spell outs, but indications. There's a lot of work involved. Because it does not indicate that all flesh is destroyed, quite the opposite. Human beings are still alive. They get born, they live, and they die still, even the kingdom of God. So that's indicated by the prophets, tell us that much. So if that happens then, that was their... Well, throws a certain type of death in the fire. What we perceive are called the deserved or earned deaths. Those who, you, because of your sins, you are going to be destroyed. That part is erased. But the prophets indicate that while God, the Father, is here on earth, and as far as Isaiah does in particular, specifies that there will still be humans who get to go or not go and at the various feast days. If they don't go, rain doesn't come on their country. Spirits don't need rain, do they? Humans, however, need rain so we can eat. Well, if God the Father's here, Zechariah says this too, the Father's here, and he's here, his presence is on earth, and humans have to come to him, people from the nations have to come to him for the holy days. They don't come, he doesn't allow rain to fall on their country. That would imply in their country there are human beings that need rain, or at least creatures or something that needs rain to live. The way it described it, the actual term usage is the God, not the thousand-year change. It's past that. It's beyond that threshold. That's the way the term that the prophets use it. So it's a funny thing. I don't want to talk about it because I'm supposed to be about break time already. But I didn't get anywhere today so far. We discussed a few brief things, about a couple things. So I want to jump through something more important after our break. So I'm going to jump to a little bit on 21 and 22. Before the break, and I'll have a break, and we'll do 23 and the Haftorah reading. So 21, as far as the shaving of head and all that stuff, that is repeated. That topic is discussed in Leviticus 19 as well as Ezekiel 44. We'll discuss that, the shaving and such, and how it's supposed to be kept later on after our break. I want to point out something very important to you. Most of us may have issues with the idea when you have the priest to be, for lack of a better term, perfect to attend or go into the temple, look at the tabernacle of God. I mean, truly perfect. No eczema, no poor eyesight. Yeah, I got poor eyesight. How many of you have wear glasses? Yeah, many of you do, right? Yeah, guess what? You're not allowed in. yeah, not me. Broken arms or legs, that doesn't mean like, oh, it's broken now. It means ever broken. How many have ever broken a bone? Guess what? We're out. We don't get to go. I have eczema. I'm out. I don't get to go. So there's a lot of people who have issues that most of us would never be allowed in. So how do we rectify this perfectness? Who is perfect? Messiah is perfect, but what everybody else? Is anybody allowed to go in? I was like, is it literally the curtains there? He tore the curtain for the fun of it, and now he's going to close it again because no one's allowed in because we're not perfect? Well, that's how John points out in 17, as well as Hebrews, that Messiah is the one who puts his perfection on you. It's his perfection on you that allows you to go in. It's not our perfection. It's he's making you perfect, not because you are, not because your limbs aren't broken or that you don't have eczema, you have good or bad eyesight. He's putting his perfection and distributing it to individuals, making them perfect. The idea of you can't go in because you're not perfect, that's right, you can't. Bottom line, you just can't. Tough luck, find another job, new occupation, because you're not going to do this one. Well, without his perfection being put upon you, you would never make it in. But if it's put on you, then you get to go in, because you've become and you've been made perfect. Let's see here. We'll discuss the wife of the high priest later, because that's rediscussed in Ezekiel 44. The crushed testicles and crushed and cut and torn and such. There's actually 2 points here earlier in verse 10 as well as in verse 24. Verse 10 is about who eats what. But verse 24, the animals that are crushed. Some of your translations will insert certain words that don't belong there, and they're incorrect because they're just plain wrong. They don't belong there. The proper reading of 24 in English, mind you, it states, it's verse 22, sorry, chapter 22, verse 24. Was it my verse 24? I think it's the same one. So one whose testicles are squeezed, crushed, torn, or cut, he shall not offer to Jehovah, nor shall you do these things in your land. And from the stranger, a hand of a stranger, you may not offer the food of your God. From any of these, for the corruption is in them, a blemish is in them. They will not find favor for you. Verse 24, many of you will, yours, not everybody's, will read something along the lines of, once it's sort of squeezed, torn, crushed, you shall not offer to the Lord your God, nor shall you offer these in your land. And you, or sacrifice these in your land. That's not what it says. The statement here is very clear. You cannot offer these, and these animals, testicles are squeezed, crushed, torn, or cut, are not to exist in your land. It's not to be done in your land. How many of you have ever heard of a steer? Ever heard of a steer? What's a steer? A castrated bull. How many of you have ever heard of, what's the goat's name when they castrate? You remember what? A gelding. Yeah. Any animal that's been castrated, not to be done in your land, anywhere. It doesn't matter if your land is in Israel or in Sonoma County. It's not to be done. Now, those of you who ever raise animals say, are you kidding? Are you crazy? That would be awful to have all these animals who are fully functional. The goats, male goats, stink. I mean, have you probably smelt male goats, right? When they're ready to mate, the smell is really, really bad. They use it as a cologne, if I recall correctly. They pee on themselves to make themselves smell good to the ladies. It's really disgusting. It's awful. Yeah, it's really gross. So, why would you not want to cut that off? What do you do with it? Mind you, the Torah was written, is there any such thing as refrigeration? No. Oh, there's such thing as freezers. Is there a way of preserving salt? Maybe you can salt it. What do you think you do with the males? Take a wild guess. You eat them early. After eight days or older, you slaughter them. That's the point. You don't have to wait until they're a whole year old to kill them. You can kill them before that. The point is, they don't have refrigeration. We buy a steer, right? Lasts us 6 months to a year, right? Yeah. You got 3 days? Maybe two, if you're lucky, and that's all you got. And then you got to eat something else. So you go through a lot of male animals very quickly, wouldn't you? So you'd have a lot of, please, let's produce more. It's okay, bring the males on, because that's our primary food source. So we look at it like, oh, it's so disgusting. Reality is, yeah, God does not want them crushed. How do we know that's what he meant? He says the same thing with the priests. Those crushed, torn, damaged with testicles prohibit them. And what are these clean animals are? What do they represent? All of us. God elevated them up to be edible. He elevated Israel up to be saved. They're symbolic of each other. Would you want yourself crushed, torn, cut, or destroyed in that area of your life? Probably not. Hence, don't do it to the animal either that you eat. Make sense? I want to point out that it refers to in your whole land is not to exist such things. Yes, Tammy.
I was just reading this from the English Septuagint. A gelding and one who is bruised and one castrated and one whose testicles are torn off, you shall not offer these to the Lord and you shall not do them in your land. And
right.
From an alien's hand, you shall not offer any of these as a gift to the Lord your God. Since there are corruptions in them, there is a blemish in them, and they shall not be acceptable.
Right.
So you're not even supposed to buy these from a foreigner.
Right, not even a foreigner.
You can't just, I'm an Israelite, so I can't castrate my goat.
But you can't go buy somebody else's.
I'm just going to let this guy do it.
Right.
No.
No passing it off. Yes, yes. So I want to point that out to us. Now, mind you, I'm not saying we all must now starve, because mind you, good luck finding animal products in the supermarket that are, that have not been cut in one way or the other. Now, and I know in kosher markets, they attempt to not do that, but depends on which market you go to, because some of them are attempting, their tempting is better than others, as far as how well they avoid those particular animals being slaughtered. The other thing I want to point out before we go into our break is it specifies in verse 10 of chapter 22, no non-priest can eat any of the priest's food. Everybody brings up the obvious example of King David. Well, he wasn't king yet, but he came up to Abiathar when he was fleeing from Saul. He said, "Hey, I'm hungry." What did Abiathar say? "Well, have any males amongst you been with a woman or not?" He said, "No, we're clean in that respect." He said, "Well, I have this food, this bread, the showbread, the matzah, or we'll discuss that today. Sorry, I should have brought that up. This bread, as far as you can eat this." What's the Torah say? "No, he may not eat this." Now, it all says if one didn't know accidentally that they ate it, they owe 1/5 once they find out. So whatever it is, they have to owe 20% more than whatever they just took. But if they knew and the priest assigned it, whose sin is it? The priest. What happened to Abiathar? He's dead. He was killed. Now, I'm not saying that's the reason he was executed, but God kills many birds with one stone. He's very, very good at that. So Abiathar and a whole lot of other men were killed, and there were a lot of reasons why. They were descendants of Eli, whom God said, "I will end this line," and so he ended the line. That's one of God's promises. He would end Abiathar's life. Also, his mistake with King David, he should not have done. So there are two issues. Both are sin death penalties that could apply to him. Therefore, we may say, "God, you were unfair." You can say that you want. God's always fair. And God placed, this is the correction he's choosing to do upon Abiathar in his life. Now, don't be wrong. King Saul went way overboard because who was guilty? Abiathar. How many men did he kill? Like 400. So King Saul, the assignment, you have one man you're allowed to execute for his crime. He said, "Okay, how's it 399? Let's kill them all." That's beyond what God said. And what happened to Saul? Saul was killed, his sons were killed, and Saul's descendants were killed for it too. So there's a lot of things that happen as far as you don't get to do certain things. You don't get to go beyond what God gave you. Any questions or comments about that? There's three of you. Go ahead. That's true. Fairness isn't part of it, right?
If he was truly fair, none of us mm-hmm. would make it in.
We'd all be dead. Yeah, that's true. We'd all be. Sorry, David, your hand was up. Go ahead.
So, how long until the showbread is replaced?
Every week.
And when it talks about the bread that David ate, if I'm not mistaken, it doesn't say that they went into the Holy of Holies and got the bread out of there.
No, did not. This is the used bread.
Exactly. So if it's the used bread, then...
It still only belongs to priest's family, though. Only the priest and his immediate family is allowed to eat it. It's still... Because it says you have to eat it in a holy place. So it implies... And it's the priest's food. Because the breads, it stays displays there all week long. Then at the end of the week, they exchange it with a new fresh loaf. Then those loaves that were exchanged, the ones that had been there all week, those are now food for all the priests. That includes all the priests, not just the high priest. It's any of them who want a piece of it. And that bread, we assume, it's not the one that's in the sanctuary, but the one that was previously there. It was there from the previous day. They had to exchange it. That's the bread the priest was using. It's still the priest's food. And then, why was I talking about this before? She was a joke last night, but it's still honest. Would you ever go to a priest's house for dinner? No. There are no dinner engagements or dinner parties at a priest's house because you can't eat it. You can't eat it. he can come to your house because he can eat your food, but you can't eat his. It has to be for him, his immediate family, his sons, his daughters who aren't married. They're the ones that eat. Not even the daughter's husband can eat it. You can't invite your wife and your daughter and her husband. I'm sorry, son, son-in-law. You can't come. If he was a priest, the husband would come. Right. If she married in the priesthood, it's the dinner parties weren't common. Yes.
Sorry. So my other thought on that was, if bread is the food of life, there's a perfect example of feeding somebody that's hungry, the bread of life.
Yes.
Or the bread as yep. food for life.
And we're going to discuss that after our break, because that topic is part of our break. We need to go into our break. Any comments? Oh yes, Larry. We're discussing a lot of things, if I have enough time. we're discussing Let's see here. I had to go a little bit on the holy days as far as, because that's part of Leviticus 23. Different parts of, there's a few things in Matthew as far as how God, how Messiah treated the Shabbat and what that means and how he treated people. Because how we treat people is the key to all, most of these passages. Is how you treat and what is freedom and how do you apply work. And because there's a lot of the holy days which discuss about work and how they apply. So any law is, I won't say the word superseded by, but is influenced by the condition of the individual you're serving. So if you are serving an individual that is in poor condition, that needs help, that trumps the law's need to what the law says you must do. Messiah gave us that example in Matthew and Luke and a few examples. We'll discuss a few of them after a break. So give it a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back after 10 minutes and stretch legs and do what you want, okay? So we are our second portion. We're jumping to Leviticus chapter 23, which officially starts in 22. Leviticus 23 is actually started officially when you read Leviticus 23. Those of you who've ever been to a holy day session at any point in time, whether it's Sukkot or Pesach or any convocation, frequently, they're not all the time, Leviticus 23 is read out loud, but they don't start to read. They always start in Leviticus 22, verse 27. They do it on purpose. It's not that they can't read the address. Leviticus 23 starts in 22, verse 27, talking about the 7-8-day thing about the animal and the goats and such, right? That's where it begins. When we deal with 7 or 8s, it's 7 plus 1, we're dealing with people or individuals. So, of rest events. So, we rest on the 7th day, the Shabbat, right? Right? Animals get their rest too. God gave the land rest as well. He gave annual rests. They're all based on this idea of rest, right? You stopped working. Now, of course, the animal gets the 8th day. So I have a question for you. Those of you who are mothers, when you gave birth, did you need some rest? How about you think animals, do they need rest too? Yeah, they do. They need rest also. What did you create when you gave birth? The noise. There was some noise, that's true. The idea is you brought forth a living being. Now, I'm not going to debate, the heartbeat, when they have, they're in the womb. But we're not discussing that topic. When you give birth, you created a living being, right? That's the idea behind it. A duplicate or a copy of what you are. Animals do the same thing. When they give birth, a copy of themselves. How many of you can duplicate yourself? Big fat zero, just in case you weren't quite sure about that. Because you're male. You can't duplicate yourself in any way. Yes, you're contributing to your wife's offspring. But the point is, you didn't give birth. You didn't do the work. She did. It's hers. You're a contributor, but not the primary creator. So in your case, men, when she gives birth, what do? You're going to work. You're working, you're going to take care of her, you're taking care of the baby because she needs her rest. You do a lot of work because it's not your rest time, it's your wife's rest time. It's your job to now serve, take care of her. In particular, she's a C-section, then you got weeks. You're busy. You got a lot of work to do. It's work involved. So when the mother gives birth, what does God say? Give her her 7 days of rest. With what she has. With the baby. Give her her days of rest. The whole time. It's hers. It's all hers. When that rest is over, you will be on 7, now 8, day 9, 10, 11, 12, 3, 6, however many months it is, she can go back to work. Now, not like get a job. The point is that now you start reintroducing being part of the family and get work done. Things happen. You have things to do. There's tasks involved. There's life to live. But she had to have her day of rest. So God gave us our commands. You give animals that rest. Why? Because they're just like you. Just like me. They need rest too. They built something severely difficult, hard to do. They built it. Give them rest. So God gives animals rest. Hence, that's why Leviticus 23 is always started in chapter 22, verse 27. Because it discusses the animal's rest first. Then we'll discuss your rest next, known as Shabbat. So I want to point out to you that's important we pay attention to that, because animals get rest. And it says you do not slaughter an animal and its mother on the same day. That means a lot of things, a lot of different people. But it includes no pregnant animals. You cannot slaughter a pregnant animal, because you will kill the baby and the mother on the same day. You can't do that. So that's prohibited. But of course, obviously, also the literal terms would obviously include the baby when the after 8 days old or 8 days old or onward, whatever the animal species is. You can't slaughter it and the mother at the same time, the same day. Not to say you they would want to, but you can't. So you have to wait until after the mother's given birth and 7 days have elapsed before the baby or even her are eligible for an offering. You cannot offer her ahead of time. You can't say, but she won't give birth till next week and the holidays this week. Who cares? She's not yours to give off. She's just, you can't offer her. You can't just short circuit, well, I'll just do it quickly now. You can't do that. You must give the whole time. She must come to full, give her offspring, give her 7 additional days at least, before either her or her offspring are offerable up to God in any way. It doesn't matter that you're trying to say, oh, but God, I'm offering them to you because you're so holy. Doesn't matter. You must wait. All right? She gets her days of rest. You get your days of rest. Attribute the same. Okay, let's continue on. Let's jump through this a little bit. See, of course, these are all God's commandments. You must observe them, of course, at verse 31 because he's Jehovah. He doesn't change his opinion. That's what it is. Chapter 23, verse 1 through 3. You will note there is a strange, we call this parentheses in Hebrew. It's a parenthetical sentence. So what it means is, if you have a list of things you're going to write or list in a particular order because they're all grouped together in a topic, but then in the middle of this, you have a sentence that really doesn't belong and you repeat the sentence here and here, this is a way in which Hebrew writes parentheses. So if I give you lists of, because we have punctuation. We have exclamation marks, we have question marks, we have quotation marks, we have commas and periods, colons, semicolons, lots of ways of trying to break things apart. That doesn't exist in biblical Hebrew. It just doesn't. So how do you do it? You say sentence here, you insert something that has no relation, and then you repeat the sentence there. That tells you to parentheses. This way you accentuate this. This item is being inserted for your information, but it's not relevant to the actual topics being listed here that follows. Make sense? So in this case, the Shabbat, it says, chapter 23, verse 1, Jehovah spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the Lord's appointed feasts, Jehovah's appointed feasts, that you are to designate as holy convocations, these are my appointed festivals. That's the sentence. Insert parenthetical sentence, verse 3. For 6 days, labor may be done on the seventh day, is a day of complete rest, a holy convocation. You should not do any work. It is a Shabbat for Jehovah in all your dwelling places. End parenthetical statement. Repeat the sentence number, verse number 2 on verse 4. These are the appointed festivals of Jehovah, the holy convocation you should designate in their appropriate time. Make sense? So Shabbat is inserted into the list about appointments, the appointed times. Now, many of you, well, Shabbat is an appointed time. Well, I'm not saying it isn't. I'm not saying it isn't. The point is, these appointed times have dates. Does Shabbat have a date of the month? No, it does not. So it's independent of month cycles, independent of holy day cycles, it is an independent thing being inserted here as a parenthetical statement. So verse 3 is in parentheses. So the overall concept when you're dealing with this topic is Shabbat day of rest, 7 days of rest, like you get the animals, that is always the case. Independent of those are the following list, the other holy days, which have dates associated with them in chapter 23 of Leviticus. Of course, it goes through the first month, 14th day of the month, the afternoon, of course, the Pesach offering. We'll go through all of these because we've already read them before. So you have, erase my zero, you have Passover and Matzot as the two, as the first two listed after, of course, after Shabbat. So each of these holidays have a particular theme God gave to them. The themes are the main characteristics that you are to do of at those holidays. So we all know most of these. So what's the theme, the main thing you're supposed to do at Passover and the Feast of Matzot? Any takers? What's the first primary theme, the thing you're supposed to do at Passover? Kill a lamb. You have a Passover meal of some form. You're observing Pesach, right? So this has a theme called Pesach, or the lamb, and the meal that goes with it, because you have to eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. So the lamb and a meal. What's the theme of Matzot? The Feast of Matzot. Feast of Matzah. What is that? What's that main topic you're supposed to do? Unleavened bread and no leavening, right? So unleavened bread. I'm going to abbreviate. And no leaven. She's looking with an E. I probably misspelled that. Oh, well. So these are the main themes associated with this particular holy day, right? So if you're observing a holy convocation, which means some people debate this, debate it with you, about a gathering or some kind of an assembly of some form, I realize that some Jewish interpreters say, well, it just means to note the day existed. Okay, but I disagree. I think it truly really means to declare or say something about the day, not just note that it existed. Anyway, so if you observe Passover Matzot and you don't do these primary themed items, are you observing it? Of course not. You're just noting that it existed. You didn't actually do anything. So a lamb with a meal and an unleavened bread, and that's part of the observation of those holy days. So this holy day, which is a point of time, has a theme to it. That's the theme. What's the theme that follows it of the raising the Omer, the 40, sorry, the 50 days of Omer? What's the theme behind that? Yep, it is counting. And what specifically are you supposed to be counting? The days, and it starts from what event? What does it begin? A first fruits. It's the first time the priest lifts up an omer, hence the name, an omer of the grass. In this particular case, it's usually barley. So, and it says explicitly here that you are not to eat any of it, the barley, the grass, the wheat, whatever grain is, until the day after the priest waves them. Now, you can eat last year's, a year before that, if it held out that long, but not the new crop. You can't eat it. So until the priest does this. And he does this, then you can go out your field, you can harvest, you can roast, cook, whatever you want to do with the various grains available to you. However, this is for you to eat. You don't get to offer any of it. You can't offer the new grains to God. Not yet. Well, he said you have to wait. The only time you get to offer it, so you can eat it all you want, the new season, that's fine. Once the priest has waved it, you can eat, consume, enjoy, have fun, put some milk on top, whatever. A little bit, cinnamon, sugar, raisin. You can't do that for God. Not yet. You have to wait. How many days must you wait? I'll give you a hint. 50 days. That's the end of the counting. At the 50-day mark, when it's completed, God says, then you will take the grain and you'll make two fluffy loaves, really big ones, and you can then offer those loaves and that point on any grain offering to God. Is now so for that new season. So this can't be offered till the 50 days of counting is done and it's all completed. And then when the Omer counting is done, now God will receive your offering. God will receive this offering you may have. I'm going to point out certain details to you that may or may not be relevant to some of you, but it's symbolic details. So in the case of the Omer offering and matzot, matzot, of course, is unleavened bread, right? You took the grain, you crushed it all up, it's powder. This is Aleph Beit pointed this out as too, which I like their explanation of this bread, which he got it from Peter Reinhardt, which is, he's a really good bread maker. great books. Anyway, discuss this topic about grains and how they work. So when we take a grain and we crush it to pieces to make it a flour, of course, the grain is now thoroughly dead, right? Can you plant that flour in the ground and spit out new crops? No, you'll get weevils, you know, some mold, maybe some whatever else. You're not going to get crops. The grain is truly dead. You killed it. It's history. It's now dead. It stays dead. And matzot is dead. Unleavened bread is dead bread. Haha. Yeah. Yeah. Pun intended. It's truly dead because it's not allowed to rise at all. What happens when it rises? What is rising? What is that? Fermenting. Yeah, it's something is alive in it, isn't it? Now here's the key. How do you make that happen? You add water. Now what does water represent in the kingdom of God regarding the Torah? The Spirit of God. That's what water represents. So you add the Spirit of God and this flour, which cannot produce anything of it. It once was a grain, now it's just powder. It can't produce anything. You add water, the Spirit of God, to it, symbolically, of course. What does it become? Alive. It's now alive again. And it's filling up its lungs, you call it, with air. Hence the God breathed into man, he became alive, the air goes in. So we have this symbolism. After 50 days of Omer, God says, I want this dead thing alive again. And now it's going to be alive. It's going to be filled with the air that I said it should be filled with. So now 50 days of Omer, you get to unleavened bread. And that gets offered to God. So leavened bread after 2 days, and this day, what day is that? What's that holy day called? Shavuot. That's the day. Shavuot is centered, the whole symbolism behind it, according to the Torah's instructions, is bread. That is the holy day's symbol. It's bread. And it's a really big, lots of bread. I'm not going to argue different kinds you can make. The point is, it's a lot of bread. That's the holy day center. That's its concept of what the symbol behind the holy day. Just like Passover had its symbol of the lamb, matzot had symbol of flat bread, Shavuot, I can write it down, Shavuot, I thought about the V. V-U-O-T. Its symbol is leavened bread. Now I realize Judaism says, well, it's all about dairy. Okay. You can think a lot of things, I don't really care. The Torah specifies symbolism is bread. That's its symbol. Now, it also has bread plus lamb, because it does discuss the different offerings, but a lot of offerings have lamb in it too, so I really can't say it's unique to Shavuot. But the Torah's instructions is Shavuot's symbol is bread, which makes sense, because what were you counting for the past 50 days? Grain. Right? For grain, you've been counting for 50. It's all been adding up and adding up. Shavuot symbol is bread. So when we say Passover has its symbols, Omer has its symbols, accounting of grain, and Shavuot has its symbol, bread. That's its bread. Now, I do realize, and of course, the Shavuot also culminates a lot of the things too. Judaism does discuss this in great opinion detail, strictly opinions, we can't prove it. That the commandments of God were given on Shavuot. No one can prove that. Maybe it's really, really close. It could have been. It's about the same time slot as far as the Torah says, because in the third month, that's when he gave the Ten Commandments, the early part of it, and Shavuot lands either 5th, 6th, or 7th of Sivan, that third month. No one can prove that's the day that God gave the Ten Commandments, but we think it probably was. Which would be, again, somewhat consistent with him giving the Spirit of God down upon the people. Right? If I give you the Ten Commandments, it's how you're going to live. Here's my Spirit, which is going to have you, is how you're going to live. The symbols are the same. So it makes sense. It's probably the same day. We can't prove it, though. Shavuot. Oh. As the Torah being given at Mount Sinai, oh, yeah. And the Spirit of God being given record the book of Acts. So the belief, you can't prove being given to the people in the book of Acts. The first chapter, I think it's Acts chapter 2, I think it is, when God's Spirit comes down, it says it's Shavuot, same day. So it's the same holy day. You can't prove the Torah was given on Shavuot. You can just prove it was within that first week there that probably was. You can't prove it because it doesn't say. It doesn't tell you that. But you can... People assumed it. I do not know about his baptism day, so I couldn't... I don't know. I've never researched that. It's possible Messiah was baptized that day. I do not know. I just don't know. It could be. Okay, so that's the next themed item. I'm going to erase some of this stuff because I don't need it. I might erase it right away. Is trumpets. Also known as Yom Teruah, called modern day called Rosh Hashanah. What's its theme? Take a wild guess. Trumpets. The theme of this one is trumpets. It's a big loud noise. It could be, you could argue, oh, thank you. I have a mark, oh, here it is. I have an eraser. I just was too lazy to find it. Anyway. Yeah, oh, there's something more. I have three erasers. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I have a lot of erasers. It's laziness or is it, what's that, selective seeing? Anyway. Same principle. Trumpet, it's blasting lots of noise. And then what's the next themed event? Rosh Hashanah's trumpets. Next themed event after that is... Yom Kippur, also David Tumwin, so Yom Kippur. Now this has two themed events on this one recorded. Did you notice that? Atonement has two themed events recorded here. What were the two events recorded? What's the two themes that it focuses on? The atonement part is one theme. What is that atonement mean? We've discussed and we've read, you know, the Leviticus 16, which discussed the goats, right? We know all that. Atonement to make you at one with God, yada, yada, yada. What are the instructions? Well, the instructions are recorded here. Instructions are recorded. The things that Leviticus 23 wants people or people humans to center around are these two topics. So I'm going to bring this out because it's important to remember. On 10th, this is verse 27 of chapter 23. On 10th day of the 7th month, David Atonement, there shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict yourselves. That's one themed event, affliction. And anybody want to, does anybody not know what that means? Okay, it means fasting. No food, no water. That's fasting. So afflict yourselves is fasting. What's the other themed event, which repeats itself many, many times in here on this particular day? To rest. He records this to rest, to not work. He repeats it multiple times. The other holy days, he doesn't repeat them. He says it once, good enough. He repeats himself many times in this one. Verse 28. You shall not do any work on this very day, for it is day of atonement to provide atonement for your, atonement before Jehovah your God. That's for any soul who will not be afflicted, that's an affliction point, on this very day will be cut off from his people, so you're dead. Any soul who will do any work in this very day, that's 2 points, I will destroy that soul from those people. You should not do any work, there's 3 times. It is an eternal decree throughout your generations, all your dwellings. It is a day of complete rest, that's 4 times. You shall afflict yourselves the 9th month, the evening, for the evening to eating. He repeats affliction 3 times and says you shall rest 4. What's the theme? Rest. Don't do anything regarding work at all. So it's a major rest day. Yes, Carrie, you're the microphone tour. Yes.
I was just thinking, why did he even need to say that many times? Because everybody falls asleep anyway.
When you don't, yeah.
Like,
when you don't eat or drink, you tend to be sleepy.
To do something when you're fasting all day? Like...
It's an important point. He doesn't want anybody to confuse the idea. And I bring this up because in a lot of holy days, you're allowed to do various things. Shabbat, you're not supposed to prepare your food. On Shabbat, it has to be already pre-prepared. And no kindling flames, right? We have that general idea. But on atonement, you're not making food, right? Right? So you don't need to cook anything because obviously you're not eating anyway. There's nothing to cook, right? So that's pretty consistent. But he has this idea of you aren't to do even other things that are permitted on other holy days. What's permitted on other holy days? Give me an example. Any ideas? What can you do on holy? That's not a Shabbat. The holy lands, let's say holy lands on a Tuesday. You can prepare food. What can you? What else can you do? Anything else? Can you move something? Like, move the table across the room. Yes, you can. Yeah, and it's not work-related. That's not laborious. That laborious work is part of what you can do. What about atonement? Rest. Rest completely. Can I move the table across the room? No. I don't know. Can you move yourself across the city? Can you drive here? See, there's a lot of things. Rest truly means rest. You do nothing. Now, it's also called a convocation. So there's also an assembly involved. How do you rectify that? It's a great question, huh? So we have to rest, but yet still come together in some fashion, whether it's not as a group here, or maybe as individuals, or I don't know. It doesn't specify how you would come together necessarily. Because all the stuff that happens on Day of Atonement, the goats and such, who does that work? What man is assigned the task, the two goats? Was it the high priest? What does everybody else do? Nothing. They watch. They do nothing else. They just watch. There's no food to eat. I can't say you don't have to go to the bathroom. You may have to do that sometimes. But the point is, other things, you don't have tasks to do. The high priest does everything. So you do nothing. You just watch. And hopefully the cord turns white. The red string, the red fabric, the dew for the goat turns white. So it's a complete rest. So that's its themes. What's Sukkot's theme? It has a bunch of trees and branches, right? There's the species of trees. I know I read mine as goodly fruit, and some of you have citron. The point is, it's a fruit tree of some form, as well as a date palm, a myrtle, and a willow. You bring those four great species for 7 whole days. You with those branches, those species, you celebrate to God, and you dwell in booths for 7 days. So you have a big temporary dwelling you're hanging out in. You eat, sleep, whatever you're doing inside of it, that's fine. So for Sukkot, this is silly. Has its theme of the four species, at least four, and I realize that I think it's Nehemiah or Ezra, adds oil tree and adds an olive tree to it. So you can up to six species. But the point is, these branches are trees you're allowed to do. Oil tree, in case you're not sure, that's a type or a relative of the pine tree. It's a fragrant smelling tree. So Sukkot has the four up to six species. How do you spell species? E-S-P-E-C. Thank you. Species of these branches plus. You have the Sukkot, the dwelling, the booths. Hence the name, because a Sukkah, the type of booth. So that's its themed event. So God broke all of his holy days and divided them up into themed events, right? Do we all know what themed events are? They're things we're supposed to do. Can you observe the holy day without doing the themed events? No, you can't. Can I have Day of Atonement and go to work? No. Can I go to Day of Atonement and not work but eat food? No. Can I go to Passover meal and not eat anything? No. Can I go to matzot and eat a bagel? No. Because you're not observing it. Can I go to Sukkot and have no branches or trees or bushes or anything like that all show with me? No. Can I go to Sukkot and not dwell in temporary dwelling? No. If you do all those things, you aren't observing what God commanded. Can I go to Shabbat and go to work the next day? Or sorry, the same day? No. You cherish your life? You swatch your tongue, what it says. Anyway, yes, David.
Yeah, I've never really thought of it before, but you know, in the early spring, you know, they do the wave offering with the grains, which are the first things to come up, first fruits. And then at the end of summer, you know, the trees are going to harvest as the last fruits. And then you're taking those trees, you know, that have all finally finished producing your olives, your later blooming
the apples,
and
the
then you're
grapes,
taking those beautiful trees and giving that as a wave offering, which is the end of the cycle, which is going to start all over again, which is...
It's a bookend. It's a perfect bookend. You start out with a waving, and you're ending with the waving. It's the same principle. You do the same thing. The difference between the first time was high priest waving, the end time, it's everybody waves. So you went through a whole progress or progression of sequences of events. And of course, the eighth day, which we already discussed many times, symbolizes God himself of Sukkot, the eighth, last day. Because Sukkot is only 7 days long. It's only seven. The eighth day is not part of this. It's called the eighth day. It's an independent holy day. The eighth day is a rest day, and the first day is a rest day, but two through seven are not rest days. Like, unless it landed on a Shabbat, we're not discussing that. But generally speaking, they're not rest days. The eighth day is its own special event, its own day of rest. What is its primary symbol? The fact that it's eight. The law doesn't give you a symbol for the eighth day. It doesn't tell you. We can argue completion, fullness, a lot of different terms. It doesn't give you a true symbol. What do we learn what the symbol means? What have we learned over time of reading not just the Torah, but the prophets in particular, the New Testament section? What does it tell us that eighth day actually means? Any takers? Any guesses? It's the kingdom. You're living with God at that point. This is God's time. Not Messiah's time, but the Creator, God's time with you. That's the symbol it means. That's the symbol behind it. We've learned that because obviously the New Testament tells us that. But that's what the symbol. So that last day is, no, you're not dwelling with just men. You're not dwelling with just Messiah. You're dwelling with God himself, the actual creator of all things, our Father. That's what the eighth day represents. So the eighth day is that event. Hence, is there a symbol that matches it? No. Try to find a symbol that matches God. It's called idolizing. You can't really do that. You can't make an idol. You can't make an image of God. You can argue that's only in English does eight look like that. Other languages it doesn't. Arabic numbers. So isn't it a symbol for God? Hence, he didn't give you a symbol for it because he's not going to give you a symbol of himself. That wouldn't work. We would idolize it. We'd worship it because, oh, look, let's bow to God, right? Because we're human. It's what we do, right? So he's not going to give us a symbol because no way, he knows us. He's not that dumb. He knows pretty well. We just worship the thing. So, no symbol because it's him. It's him. He is the symbol. That's all about him. It's our time with him. Okay. I'm not going to go through all the stories and sections about the chapter 24. Yeah, the guy cursed God's name. Big shock there. Don't curse God's name. It's not that hard. It's pretty obvious. Cursing is one thing. You bear your sin. Cursing God, that's the sin. Cursing God's name, you were executed on the spot. Any questions? Any comments regarding that topic? You don't curse your God's name. Because very clearly, don't curse. Now, he doesn't say you can't curse your God. It says don't curse your God's name. So, and hit meaning him. You can curse your God. It says you will bear your sin. Whatever that means, you are not executed on the spot if you curse your God. But if you curse your God's name, including identifying his name in your curse, you are executed on the spot. You're like, well, wow, that's really harsh. No, it's not. That's reasonable. Yes, David.
I think if you would do any kind of a contract, you know,
right.
It was always written by their... You know, their God was their witness, and their God
right.
was who sealed that contract.
And they would rattle off all the gods of both parties, and they would listen both of the contracts.
Right.
That's correct.
And if they broke that contract or defiled the terms of the contract, that was also blaspheming God.
Yes.
And using his name in vain.
Correct. Correct. There's a contract. I can't remember who wrote it, but it's a Hittite contract between two individuals, a king and a prince from different countries. The same thing. They rattle off each and says, I think this, you do this. We each have our gods that identify it. If something goes wrong, our gods will kill us. And that was the idea.
And then I asked earlier at the beginning about the native born being used.
Oh, right. Oh, right, right. Thank you. So the Sukkot, I should have mentioned it. The Sukkot, it specifies the native born. that implies or specifies proselytes, converts. Those are not native born. So they're not required to observe Sukkot. Their children, however, are. Because once you're a proselyte, meaning a convert, your children are now native born, assuming you have children. You don't, okay. But if you have children, your children become native born citizens. So you don't have to observe this, but your children do. As far as Sukkot and the four species of the booths. And why is that? Because God specified, I brought them, remember, I made them dwell in booths when we brought them out of Egypt for 40 years. It's a long time. Well, if you're a convert, you didn't participate in that. But your children, because you converted and you were part of, you attach yourself to God's name, your children by default, one law for everybody, become a native-born citizen. So they are native-born. But what if you already have children? Maybe their children are teenagers or preteens when you convert. Well, God specifies that you are your own independent person from the age of 20 and up. Below that, you're not. 20 and up. 20, you're fully responsible. So you can't say, but mom and dad taught me this. I should always do this. And he says, you're 21. Get the boot. You know better than that. You can't blame somebody else. So if your parents, whatever, if they follow God, say, hey, I'm putting my hat on. I am following this particular God. I'm following this procedure. This is who I follow. Your children, assuming they are following you because they're in your household, hopefully they're in your household, at the age of 20, whatever they were, wherever that you are at that age is who they are. So if you are a proselyte, and let's say your firstborn daughter and son, one was 17 and one was 19, and you are a proselyte, say, I'm hooking my hat onto God's hook there. I'm following him. This is the Torah observant life I want to live. I'm a proselyte. When this 19-year-old converts to 20, which eventually they will, hopefully, they are now a native born. Funny, huh? The Torah scripture is the 20 years and up, you are fully responsible. Under that, you're under your parents' realm. Oh, that's a crud. It's when he killed all, it was the numbers. He kills. It's the spies come back. I can't remember. It's numbers. Spies come back from spying out the land. Yeah, somebody find it. Spies come to spy out the land. They all come back and then they get the bad report, right? And there's Caleb and there's Joshua who say there's a good report. And so, and all the spies, they say, oh, well, it's bad land, bad land, bad land. The people say, oh, yeah, it's bad land. We'll all agree with you. And God then issues, for 40 years, everybody who's 20 and up at that point will die. So everybody who's under 20 is not included in this rebellious section who said, I'm not going to follow God's land. Under 20 is exempt from this rule. Therefore, they are not applied for this rejection. So once you reach 20, your holy God holds you wholly responsible for everything you do. Under that, you're not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that was in the wilderness.
Yeah, it's in the book of Numbers. I don't remember the exact verse or chapter. It's a whole chapter dedicated to the topic. I just don't remember about that section, about the whole 20 and up are all executed. What was that? Numbers 145? The military. Oh, yeah, in 20 years, also military is included in that count as well. That's how they're counted. And then the spies, east side, west side. Oh, Numbers 14 of the spies. Okay, so 25, that's when identified when your age is threshold, when your age is marked 20 years and up. And what was in Numbers 14? 20 and up, right. Yeah, the water to die. So it tells God's measurement threshold is 20 and up. That's what he says. This is, we do 18 in our country. Yeah, we do 18 and 21 because we have different thresholds of alcohol. we split the difference almost. So we have our own threshold. So the native born becomes a person who becomes that when their parents have chosen to be this. That's what the classified. Now I do realize Judaism today says no, the person's age of 13. They mark it at 13 instead of 20. Whatever. The bar mitzvah, they mark it at, Judaism today says 20's too old. We'll convert. We'll drop this down to 13. You know, maybe they have smarter children. I don't know. I'm not going to say they're right or wrong. It doesn't matter. It just is. Now, in some, there's, I forgot the rabbi's name. I can't remember his name. Oh, I can't remember his name. Anyway, he argued that no, native born means both parents have to have been physically born as Israelites. That's his argument for native born, which what we do actually is similar to our own country divided native born. I'm not going to go into a man's opinion, but, and I believe his opinion, the native born, both parents be native born, actually is the dominant, the controlling opinion today. I'm not going to say whether he's right or wrong. God doesn't specify that, doesn't specify what that looks like. All we know is that he thresholds and measures people at 20. That's all the Torah tells us. That we can apply more stringent results on it or opinions. That's fine. You can do whatever you want. But that's all the information we're given on this topic. Let's move forward because I've got one thing I want to talk about. I'm already out of time. It's the Haftorah reading. This is going to go through real quick because it's just an interesting point that addresses something that is seemingly strange. So jump to Ezekiel. Ezekiel 4, chapter 44. I will not have time to go through the New Testament's topic regarding how you treat those who sin, those who are breaking the law and how it applies. I did mention briefly, Matthew 12 does talk about a type of service, which I'll just read off right now, discussing that the law of the Sabbath and his disciples are gathering grain and eating grain. This is Matthew 12, 1 through 8. I'm doing a parenthetical sentence here. And it points out that he's the law, the Messiah is the Lord of the Sabbath too. In the description given there, it also records better, in my opinion, in Mark, his similar event. It points out that the need is the dominant choice when you're choosing between following God's laws, explicit letter, or having to go against them for some reason. The need, not the want, but the need. So for example, a starving man who's about to die, and it's Yom Kippur, do I give him water? Yes! It's a lot. You have to make the person live. So the need, person who's dying here, is a greater need than the law's instruction. So you have to weigh the need as well as the instruction, not just need. Now, don't confuse need with want. I want this, or I have chosen to do this on this particular day. That is not a need. That is a want, a choice. You chose to do something which is different than a need. A need is so-and-so is about to perish because this thing is needed. That is a need. Hence, you fix the need. Make sense? Yeah, the Good Samaritan, exact same story. It could have been any holiday makes a difference. The Good Samaritan story is the need was there. Fix the need, regardless what it does to you or how you may be breaking a particular law. Now, I use this example on purpose. I know some of you may disagree with me because it comes up a couple of times. One of them is the lame man who got Messiah said, pick up your bed and walk, right? Oh, he commanded to carry a burden on Shabbat. Ah, that's the command. You can't carry a burden on Shabbat, which, of course, the book of Jeremiah says so. That need of the freedom for the man was greater than not picking up the bed. I will propose this to you. If you are a lame individual, you cannot walk, and then all of a sudden you are given the full strength and ability to walk, what are you going to do? You're going to run and jump and scream and shout. Well, look what happened to me. Picking up that bed was one of the first things I would do. Why? Because I couldn't do it yesterday. No one could do it. No one could help me do it. They had to do it for me. This shows I am now truly free. That is a greater rest than I had the day before. So me as a human being, he wouldn't have had to say, pick up your bed and walk. I'd have picked it up and shouted and jumped and ran. And look what happened. That's what I would have done. I'm a human being. And would I be upset the fact it was Shabbat? No way. Would I care that's better than Shabbat? Probably not. I'd be more focused on the fact that look well for the freedom I now have. I was once bound, and now I'm not. That's how I would respond. I'm not saying you would respond or agree. That's how I would respond. Yes. Oh, back right over here.
Said Mark, and I was wondering.
Oh, if the Mark. The Mark reference was the
man
a,
was
the
not
synoptic.
Made, the Sabbath was made for man, not man
right.
for the Sabbath.
Correct. Correct. Exactly. That's the reference. Now, did Messiah break the Shabbat? No, not really. The priests didn't break the Shabbat either, but yet they were working. There's an example. A lot of people didn't break the Shabbat, but yet they still worked those days. There were things to be done. Why? Because the need outweighed the requirement. What if the priests did not serve on Shabbat? What happens? You have no lambs slaughtered, which is required by law. You have no offerings taken care of, which is required by law, any form of offerings. There are no circumcision done for that matter either. Well, in modern day at least, no circumcision done. There are no prayers offered. There'd be no incense offered. There'd be nothing done on Shabbat if the priests obeyed the Shabbat. Why? That means these needs were more important than their rest. The need of the prayers and the forgiveness of sins was more important than the high priests or the regular Levite priests' days of rest. The Levites get days of rest. The first 500 years? No. So Solomon came along and said, now we're going to do this in shifts. Then they got rest. But before that, there was 500 years of no rest. You do this till you're dead. That's just how life works. But I won't go into the details beyond that. So this, That's the extent to which I would talk about that topic. I had to jump to Ezekiel 44 because this book was that close to be thrown out of all your Bibles. This close. Ezekiel, the whole book of Ezekiel. It almost never made it into your Bibles. It almost never made it to the Tanakh. It was this close. No, by the rabbis. Because there are commands in here that break the Torah. See, if a man tells you, go against the Torah, Moses already said, get rid of him. Oh, yeah. So Ezekiel has commands in here that's not what the Torah says. It was that close being thrown out. That close. The whole book of Ezekiel, but we're going to book chapter 44, and we're starting in verse 15. Now, this is one of, not the only one, of the controversial statements Ezekiel says in here. So Ezekiel 44, starting in verse 15, it will go through the end of the chapter. I will stop periodically, so be worth me. So starting in verse 15, but the priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok, who kept charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near me and to minister to me, and they shall stand before me to offer to me the fat and the blood, says the Lord God of Israel. So, stop there for a minute. Who are the sons of Zadok? Anybody take a wild guess? Take a wild guess. What does Zadok sound like? Zadok?
Zachary.
Sounds like Zadik, doesn't it? What's the word Zadik mean? Righteous. Ever heard of the word Zadokim? Have you ever heard of the word Sadducee? Same word. Same word. Sadducee and Zadokim, the sons of Zadok, are the same word. Yeah, it's actually the same translation. It's Zadokim. So the sons, oops, that's an N, of Zadok equals Sadducee. I'm going to misspell this, forgive me. U-C, 2-E, S-A. Okay, Sadducee. These are the same. Sons of Zadok and Sadducee is the same person, same group of people, same category. Now, don't get me wrong. The Sadducees did a little screwy things. But not at the beginning, they didn't. The screwiness didn't happen until a few years before Herod showed up. They started to do some really funny, bizarre, you know, we could do this, we can go back and forth a little bit in far as how they did things. But who was John the Baptist's dad? What was he? A Sadducee. He's a descendant of Zadok, the sons of Zadok. Right? Because who was Zadok? Zadok, the man, was high priest. High priest during Solomon's reign. Well, that's Melchizedek, which is a similar spelling word. It's not by accident God used the term righteousness and reused it again and again and again. But the man himself was high priest under King Solomon's time. That was the man. He was also alive as a young man when David was trying to evade his son who was trying to kill him. But we'll go all the details. But that's who the man was. He received the high priesthood after all the Abiathar we talked about earlier with Saul. He and his descendants were all wiped out, and then Solomon had, there were two men left. One was a descendant of Eli, and one wasn't. And Solomon, when he became king, knocked off the Eli's descendant, and now Zadok became the high priest. So Zadok was a high priest. So God's saying, the sons of Zadok, the Sadducees, he's who he's referring to in verse 15 of chapter 44. Now, the Sadducees were, initially, fantastic people. Good, righteous, holy men. And they were all the way through, even up to the point of the Maccabees. These were the good guys. The best of the best. They followed God as best they could. They followed all of his laws as best they could. And they were diligent followers. So when we look at John the Baptist's lineage, where his dad was, the philosophy that they followed, keep in mind who these men were, not who they became, but who they were, how they started out. When this prophecy of Ezekiel is being recorded, these are the best of the best. All right? And they're all descendants of a high priest. That's a key thing to not forget. All descendants of a high priest. So they all have right to the high priest anointment. Verse 16. They shall enter my sanctuary, they shall come near my table to minister to me, and they shall keep my charge. And it shall be, whenever they enter the gate to the inner court, that they shall put on linen garments, no wool shall come upon them, while they minister within the gates of the inner court or within the house. Stop for a minute. Wool. I will not say this is right or this is wrong, but in your Torah, when it discusses the blue yarns, the red yarns, the purple yarns, rabbinic instruction specifies, the Torah doesn't say so, that they are wool items. And then it specifies linen independent of these different colored items. I cannot swear to you or correctly state that these items had to be wool. Maybe they were, maybe they're not. But the high priest would wear both linen and wool. The regular priests would not wear wool. They would wear linen tunics or linen turbans, linen items alone. But these individual men are specified, told, the sons of Zadok, do not wear any wool. You would wear linen alone. For your underwear, to your hat, clothing, it's all linen alone. And no wool. I bring that up because this upsets a few people, because the Torah, mind you, these are all descendants of the high priest. All of them are descendants of the high priest. So if I say, high priest, you are allowed to wear wool and linen, but all your descendants, not a single one's allowed to wear wool. What did I just do? I just segregated, said there are no descendants from you that are allowed to be high priest anymore. Right? Because a high priest can wear wool as well as linen, as is the rabbinic law or the oral law's command. They can wear both. And only them. Even Josephus supports that philosophy. He said the same thing. They can wear both. But in this instruction from Ezekiel, all the descendants of the high priest, that means all descendants, but even if the firstborn, the next high priest, when Zadok dies, yeah, the next, his oldest son, that group would be categorized as not being permitted to wear wool. Therefore, these are no longer high priests anymore. Ezekiel's recording it. This is a recording about, you know, 560, 580, something like that, AD. Or BC, I mean. Let's continue on. But mind you, this is one of the controversial things that Judaism does not ignore, but has to address. It's one of the reasons why the book almost didn't make it in your Bibles. Let's see, verse 18. They shall have the linen turbans on their heads, linen trousers on their bodies. They shall not clothe themselves in anything that causes sweat. When they go out the inner court, the outer court, the people, they shall take off their garments in which they have ministered, lead them to the holy chambers, and put on the other garments in their holy garments. Thus with them they shall not sanctify the people. Now we've run across that strange thing before, that something comes out of the temple, has the ability to make somebody who's not in it holy. It's really strange. But God does do that. He did the Torah as well. That's not fully understood, and I won't try to explain it. Something comes out of it to make somebody who once did it becomes holy. Yeah, it's strange, but in the Torah, he says the same thing on a few items. K1, verse 20. Nor should they shave their heads, nor let their hair grow long. They should keep their hair well trimmed. This is not a dig at modern Orthodox Judaism, but the long locks on the side, Sorry, guys. That's long, and it's part of your hair. You can't shave it, nor you need to trim it. So no, you let it grow long. So you have to keep it trimmed, but not shaved clean, but don't let it grow long either. It's not a dig at them. I'm not saying they're doing anything wrong. The point is, none of them are high priests anyway. It doesn't make a difference. But in the priestly, priests would never dress that way. Yes, Jared.
To clarify, the Orthodox that have those long, curly peyotes, they call it.
Yeah.
Well, not all of them, but the Orthodox people that do have them. It's not an attempt to be a high priest. It is a, like, super ultra way of following the commandment of not shaving the sides of your head.
Right. It's going beyond what the... You're going to extra extreme effort to do that. Let's see why. No priest, verse 21, no priest should drink wine when he enters the inner court. That makes sense. We already know that. They should not take as a wife. Here's the key point that's strange. They should not take as a wife, a widow or a divorced woman, but take virgin descendants of the house of Israel or widows of priests. Say what? Wait a minute. The Torah in Leviticus we just read, the high priests, which one of these guys had to be high priests, right? Because they're all the sons of Zadok, can now marry a widow of another priest. But the Torah says they can't. Again, we have a strange grouping. So the priest widow, they can marry. Even the biological descendant of the high priest who would be anointed high priest. So we have two categories that are strange book of Ezekiel, that contradict the Torah's instructions. So what's going on? Why is this? How could Ezekiel do that, and we can still consider him a prophet of God? This doesn't make any sense. You can't be teaching against God's command. That breaks the laws. But that's what Ezekiel's precisely doing. Let's finish off this. They should teach my people the difference between holy and unholy, cause them to discern between unclean and clean. In controversy, they should stand as judges and judge according to my judgments. They should keep my laws, my statutes, all my appointed meetings. They should hallow the Sabbath. They should not defile themselves by coming near to a dead person. Only for a father, mother, son, or daughter, or brother, or unmarried sister may they defile themselves. Stop. Defile. A son of the high priest isn't supposed to defile himself even for a dad, or a mom, or a wife, or a brother, but now it's all of them. So, close family. So we have these three markers that are different than the Torah instructs us. After he's cleansed, he shall count 7 days for him. On the day that he goes for the sanctuary to minister the sanctuary, he must offer his sin offering in the inner court. That makes sense. The Torah says the same thing. It shall be in regard to the inheritance that I am their inheritance. You shall give them no possession in the land, for I am their possession. They should eat the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering. Every dedicated thing in Israel should be theirs. The best of all fruits of any kind, every beast of any kind from all your sacrifices should be the priest's. Also, you shall give to the priest the first of your ground meal to cause a blessing to rest on your houses. The priest should not eat anything, bird or beast, that died naturally or was torn by wild animals. So all this remaining section, all is correct, and that it categorizes all priests in this category, but even that, even the high priest is included in here too in this list. So some of these items were originally only given to high priests, but now they're given to everybody. The best of your land was not just the priests. The high priest had to have the very best. Well, now all these men, sons of Zadok, get the very best. So the best is given. Now, here is my, Daniel Agee's, opinioned answer. My opinion. You don't agree with me? My opinion. How did this, of this wool, the priest, the allowed to marry a priest's widow, defiling oneself for close family, the best given to you, apply to sons of the high priest who would be prohibited on some of these things or permitted for certain things? How did this category get created? Why did God create this category? And why is this being done? Ezekiel 44. Where does this fall in Ezekiel's list of things he's telling us about? Have you looked at Ezekiel 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43? What are those topics? They are future events. Something in the future is going to happen. He talks about all these future temples being built. So this category is being created as a future event, a future category. Why do you think Ezekiel will be telling us about this? Yes, Anne?
It has something to do with Ezekiel 38 being, you know, the times of destruction of Israel and all that.
That have occurred. Ezekiel, in his prophecy, covers a lot of different things in his book. Lots of stuff. And in Ezekiel 38 is part of it. So a lot of his discussion, which he discussed in Ezekiel 38, which is the two sticks, the reunification of the house under the Messiah's hand. So I have an obviously dumb question because you already know the answer to this. In the future, who's supposed to be the high priest? The Messiah, Yeshua is. Messiah is, right? So is there really going to be a true descendant of the original high priest that matter? Not in the way Yeshua matters, not in the way that the high priest mattered anymore. So what did he do? God took the descendants of the high priest and said, I'm going to make you in your own unique category. I'm not getting rid of you. I am making you into a unique category. You are no longer high priests, but you're not regular priests either. Because these categories do not follow regular priest rules either. But at some point in time in the future, the actual true descendants, the people who are by biological law permitted to be high priests, won't be anymore. But what will they be doing? The same thing as Ezekiel tells them to be doing. They're still doing similar work, almost identical work. But they don't get the high priest's rule anymore. They have their own unique grouping. It's a strange blend between what they once were and what the regular Levites are. It's a mixed combination of what they once were. God created a new group of priests. He divided them up. Why? Because the high priest line just ended. You're no longer high priests. You're no longer the same as you once were before. Regardless of your voice, they're righteous men, good men. Sons of Zadok, they were good men. God's not going to cast them aside as you're all equal the same now, because you're not. You did your best to live what was right and holy and good and just and perfect, however perfect that was. But it's a different category being built. Because I cannot explain, in my personal opinion, why God would generate a new category of Levites that include all the sins of the high priest, but not the rest of Levites. And that's the only thing I can think of. Because Messiah became the high priest. And Messiah doesn't have children, right? Not biological. He can't have his own progeny continuing on. That's my personal Daniel Ages opinion. Don't agree with it, but that's my opinion. I'm going to end. Do you have any questions or comments? I'm way over time. I apologize for that. Oh, sorry. I don't mean to be over people's head. It's symbols. When you're using symbols, they can get you confused at times. It can be confused a lot, too. No, it doesn't specify. It says, all Ezekiel says, it's sometime, I would believe, our existing future, not our day, but sometime in our messianic age type period. Because the chapters before discuss this massive temple that is just huge in size and scope and far bigger than anything else and what this temple can do that has never existed. Nothing that big has ever existed. So it's something that's in the future that appears that Ezekiel's talking about. Even future from now. Not currently. When Messiah, apparently, it refers to the king coming in and out of the temple, has to be Messiah's here doing it. So Messiah must be here at this time when he's recording it. And obviously Messiah isn't. We can look around us and see that. So sometime in our future, it's supposed to occur. We don't know what it looks like, but that's what it appears to be. Yes, David.
So, you know, I'm going to go back to the native-born tabernacle thing.
Yep.
It's just been rolling around in the back of my head, and I just wanted to get your opinion on a thought that came to mind. And I was thinking, you know, that as the Israelites were taken out of bondage and commanded to go out from bondage and to leave Egypt, and then because of their disobedience, they ended up wandering for 40 years. But they were pretty much told to do that as the native born, where the sojourners or those that were with them, they were like, oh, wow, there really is a God. These people really do have a God. I'm going with them because, you know, whatever he has in store for them is probably a lot better than what's going on here in Egypt, especially after they leave. I could be a slave or whatever took place. But they weren't really commanded to go out as, you know, I mean, the lesson was for the native born. The fact that they, because of their disobedience, they lived in huts for 40 years before they were able to go into the promised land. And so, and then my other thought on that was simply, you know, even though we're not commanded, you know, as grafted in, you know, if we're not doing this, how will our children learn who will be native born? So,
right.
Even though it's not commanded,
it's not wrong.
It's definitely a foreshadow of things to come.
It's still a future thing to do. I completely agree. A proselyte, when a convert says, "I'm going to follow God's laws," there are certain things don't apply to you, but your children wouldn't learn them if you didn't follow them anyway. There's a lot of laws that they're written that way. There are a lot of laws that, well, applies this person this way and this person that way. For example, the whole slavery law of, well, if he's a foreigner, you can keep him forever. Well, if he's, yeah. But if you obeyed those laws in that way, your children would never learn the release of what God offers. There's a lot of things which say, okay, yes, I'm not required to do these things because I am of this genetic line. But I want to attach myself. I want to change my lineage from here to over there. To do that, I have to live like that and teach my children to live like that. So they will become like that. Not where we came from, where we're going to.
Just one more passing thought. Because we're talking about the feast.
Yep.
You know, many of these will be continued in the millennium. And it seems funny to me that as a Christian, I knew this, but when we get there, what are we going to have to all be? I mean, how will we know to do these if we're not doing them now?
If you don't know how to do them already,
how to do Christmas. I mean, let's go chop a tree and decorate it.
Right.
I mean, how ridiculous is that we're not focusing on how to do them now if we're going to be commanded to do them in the millennial? I mean, it may not be me, but my child or my child's child. And if we're not continuing this pattern, we're going to all go there and go, duh.
Yep.
Silly.
Yep, that's an accurate statement. Any comments or questions? I'm going to call it quits. I'm going to close the prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for our Shabbat day of rest. Father, we ask you to bless us and keep us safe. Bless the rest of our Shabbat, Father. We fellowship with one another. And we have learned and tried our best to understand you. Please continue to help us to learn. Help us to continue on in our walk with you, our struggles with you. It will be good, honorable people, true sons of you. We praise you, Father, and ask your blessing the rest of our Shabbat in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.